Today's subject is, I think, an interesting one and an important subject at that, about karma. The spelling of the word in Pali is K-A-M-M-A. It is the same as the Sanskrit spelling K-A-R-M-A. They mean the same thing. If you prefer Sanskrit, then it should be K-A-R-M-A. And in Pali, the conjunct consonants are assimilated or simplified. And so R and M become M-M. Now what is karma? The word karma has become a household word nowadays, even in the West. Even non-Buddhists use this word. So what is karma? Karma is explained as an action or a deed. Basically, the word karma means work or a job or action or a deed. But in this sense, meaning some cause that produce results, karma is defined as that by which actions are done or through which actions are done. That means not the action themselves or the deeds themselves are called karma, strictly speaking. But whenever we do something, there arises in our mind a type of consciousness. And that type of consciousness is accompanied by what we call volition, cetana. And that cetana is what is called karma in this case. Buddha explicitly said that volition or cetana I call karma. Through volition one performs the action by body, by speech or by mind. So the actions are divided into three: those done by body, and those done by speech, and those done by mind only, not with body and speech. So, whatever action we do, there arises in our minds a type of consciousness, either wholesome or unwholesome. And that type of consciousness is accompanied by volition, cetana. And that cetana is what we call karma. But popularly, say we say karma means action, or karma means good or bad deeds. But strictly speaking, karma is the volition in our minds. So technically, karma is the volition that is associated with 12 unwholesome cetas and so on. Now, I think you remember that cetana accompanies every type of consciousness. Cetana is concomitant with all 89 or 121 types of consciousness. That means whenever a type of consciousness arises, cetana is also with it. But cetana accompanying all types of consciousness is not called karma, but only that which accompanies wholesome and unwholesome types of consciousness is called karma. There are 12 unwholesome types of consciousness and 8 beautiful wholesome sensuous consciousness, the first column of the 24, and then 5 wholesome form sphere cetas consciousness from rupa vachara, and 4 wholesome formless sphere consciousness. So we have how many? 12 29. So Chaitanya accompanying these 29 types of consciousness is called karma. And this karma is what is described as sankhara in the teaching of dependent origination. In the dependent origination, we have 12 links, and the first is ignorance. And what is the second link in the dependent origination? The second is called mental formations. Mental formations really mean karma here. And it is this karma which produces result in this life or in future lives. So the Chaitanya accompanying these 29 types of consciousness is what we call karma. Now, in some suttas, some mental factors associated with volition are also called karma. And if you want to read further, then please see Expositor, page 117. But for convenience sake, let us take that Chaitanya is what is called karma, and let us forget about other Chittasikas associated with volition or Chaitanya being called karma. Now, Chaitanya is one of the 52 Chittasikas, but it is different from other Chittasikas. You know, a Chittasika is a mental factor or mental state, and so it arises and disappears. Chaitanya also arises and disappears. But Chaitanya is different from other Chittasikas because when it disappears, it leaves something of a potential to give results in the continuity of beings. So it leaves something behind, some power, some ability to give results. So when it disappears, it does not disappear altogether. It leaves something, some kind of potential to give results in the future. And these potentials, or we can just call it karma, are something like investment. See, they are in store for us because we... And through our lives, we do sometimes good karma and we do sometimes bad karma. And they are in store for us. And this karma or the potential to give results really give results when conditions are favorable. When the conditions are not favorable for it to give results, then it will not give results at that time or at that in that location or whatever. But when the necessary conditions are met with, then the karma or this potential give results. Although it is said that the potential is left by Chaitanya when it disappears, we cannot say where it is located, where it is stored. People often ask where karma is stored. And it is not a modern question because King Milinda, about 500 years after the death of the Buddha, asked the same question of the Venerable Nagasena. He said, people do good deeds and bad deeds. Or he said, Nama and Rupa, mind and matter, do good deeds and bad deeds. And where can you point out those and say they are here or they are there, something like that? And the Venerable Nagasena said, no, we cannot point out that karma is stored here or there. And King Milinda was very fond of maybe similes, so please give me a simile. So the Nagasena said, it is like fruits and tree. We cannot find out that fruits are stored in this tree, in the trunk or in the roots or in the branches or whatever. But when the necessary conditions are fulfilled, when there is sunshine and when it is season and when it gets moisture and so on, then it bears fruit. It becomes fruitful. But we cannot say that fruits are stored here or there in the tree. So in the same way, it is impossible to say that karma is stored here or there or anywhere. But somewhere, we don't know where, it is, and it is waiting to give results as soon as the conditions are favorable for it. Say, good karma or bad karma. If you have a book called Milinda's Questions, and you may read that book. Do you have that book in the library? Yes. Yeah. It's a very interesting book. And it contains questions and answers, and very naughty questions, very difficult to answer. There are two English translations. One was made by, I think, Rhys Davids long ago. That is Questions of King Milinda. And then I.B. Horner made a new translation, and she named it Milinda's Questions. There are two volumes. So, now, what is karma? Karma is volition, or volition is karma. And sometimes some other mental factors associated with volition, arising together with volition, are also called karma. And karma has a potential to give results in the future. And we do not know where this karma is stored in our continuity. But it is somewhere. Now, what karma is not? Now, when writing about karma or speaking about karma, many people say different things about karma. And some say that karma means both cause and effect. But in this case, technically speaking, and in Buddhist teachings, karma is not result, but the cause. Although, in popular speech, we use the word karma to mean its results. If something good happens to you, and you say, it is my good karma. Or if something bad happens to you, say, it is my bad karma. People used to say this. But actually, it is not the good karma or bad karma, but the result of the good karma or bad karma. Say, you're lucky at the lotto or somewhere. Then you say, oh, it is my good karma. Actually, it is the result of my good karma, or it is the result of my bad karma. So, in popular speaking, we use karma to mean results sometimes. But technically, karma is never a result, but just the cause. Even in our texts, sometimes karma is used in the sense of results of karma. So the verse from Dhammapada, not in the sky, nor in mid-ocean, nor in the mountain cave is found a place on earth where abiding one may escape from evil karma. And in Pali it is papa karma, evil karma. Really means from the consequences of evil karma. We'll come to that in a moment. So, in popular speaking, we would use karma sometimes to mean its results. But technically, karma never means a result, but the cause. Now, people often ask whether karma is fate or predestination. And my answer is, to some extent, it seems to be But many authors say that it is not fate or it is not predestination. Maybe they mean that it is not fate or predestination in a Christian sense. It is not fate or predestination imposed upon us by the external agent or something. But when we read stories in the Buddhist literature, we cannot avoid thinking that karma is something like fate or predestination. So karma may be, to some extent, predestination, but not imposed by any person or any agent, but it is just the natural law. We will come to that later. See the quotation given above and the stories in Buddhist legends, part 2, page 286 to 291. There's a book called Buddhist Legends. There are three parts in that series. That book is a translation of the commentary to Dhammapada. You know, the Dhammapada is a collection of verses only, and the commentary gives us stories leading to the utterance of these verses by the Buddha. And the Dhammapada contains mostly contemporary stories or occurrences during the time of the Buddha, not like Jataka stories. Jataka stories are those that that occurred long before Buddha came to the present world. So many stories are given there, and there are three stories given in connection with the verse given above. Not in the sky, one story. Nor in mid-ocean, another story. Nor in a mountain cave, yet another story. So there are three stories, and I'll tell you only one story, the last one. The Buddhist legend was published by Harvard University. It is in Harvard Oriental series. And there are three volumes. Narada's is just very short, just like synopsis of the stories. Once there were seven cowherds, boys, and they used to tend cows. So one day when they returned to their place, they saw a large lizard. So they ran after the lizard to catch him. But the lizard was quicker than these boys, and so it went into an ant hill. And it is said that there were seven holes to that ant hill. So the boys decided, we cannot catch it today. So tomorrow we'll come and catch him. And they closed the holes with twigs and other things that they get, so the lizard was kept inside. So next day they went to another place for the cows, and so they forgot about the lizard. But on the seventh day, when they came back, they saw the ant hill, and so they remembered, and so they say, "Well, what has become of the lizard there?" So they removed the blockades, and then the lizard hasn't eaten for 7 days, and so it was in the book. It is said that it was just skin and bones, so it came out, and when it came out, the boys had pity on it, so they said, we should not kill this lizard. It has suffered a lot. It has not eaten for 7 days, and so they let him go. So that karma, they did not kill the lizard, but they something like imprisoned him. So from that from that life, they say they died and they are reborn here and there. And during the time of the Buddha, they were the seven monks. And one day they went to see the Buddha. And when they reached the monastery, they were given a cave to stay for the night or for as long as they were there. So there were seven beds in the cave. And so when the seven monks came, and the cave was assigned to them. So they slept in the cave. And during the night, a big rock, as big as a stupa, just fell down and blocked their entrance. So they could not get out. And the monks outside tried, with lay people, tried to remove the big rock, but they couldn't. It went on for 7 days. And so on the seventh day, the rock rolled by itself. And so the cave was open again, and the monks could come out. So they asked the Buddha, and Buddha related the story. Since you did not kill the lizard when you were boys, you did not suffer in hell. But for 14 consecutive existences, you are without food for 7 days. So, the consequences of bad karma here cannot be escaped. It follows a man like the wheel following a draft ox or like a shadow. So, it is something like predestined that they are to be in that cave at that time, and the big rock was to fall and block the cave, and then on the seventh day, the rock was just to be to roll it by itself, and they came out again. So something like fate or predestination. So I think karma is to some extent predestination. But not everything we experience in this life is the result of karma. We will come to that later. And is there such a thing as mass karma? And the venerable Nyanatiloka, a German Buddhist monk, said there is no such thing as mass karma. But there are stories which would suggest that there is mass karma, but actually there is no mass karma. Karma of the individuals ripening at the same time, at the same place. What I mean by writing no mass karma affecting collectively means, say, no one karma affecting a group of people, but some people do something together, and so the effect of this also they get together. So in this way, we could say that there is something like a mass karma, but there is no mass karma. But individual karma giving results at the same time at the same place, and there are stories of these. One is the destruction of Buddha's relatives at the hand of Vidudaba. Vidudaba was a son of a slave girl and a prince of a Sakya clan. And it is said that those of Sakya clan were very proud. And so when the son came to pay homage to his grandfather, out of politeness, they didn't do anything at that time. But when he went back, they washed the place with milk, because a son of a slave has sat on this seat, and so it is polluted, something like that. You know the caste system in India. And it happened that one of the men of the prince Vidudaba went back to take something which he had left behind, and so he heard this. So he told Vidudaba about this, and so Vidudaba knew that he was a son of a slave girl and a Sakyan prince. So he had grudge against Sakya people. When he became a king, he decided to kill all Sakya people. So he had a great army, and he went out of the city. Now, Buddha wanted to protect his relatives. So Buddha went out and sat under a tree which is not good shade. It was the sun was shining. So when Vidudapa came to him, he asked, "Why are you under such a small tree? It couldn't cover you all." Then Buddha said, "The shade of relatives is cooler than the shade of a big tree." So he got the hint, and Buddha wanted him to spare his relatives, and so he went back. Next time he remembered this, he remembered the humiliation or insult, and he got the army ready and went out again, and Buddha intervened again. And so three times Buddha tried to revert this danger. But on the fourth time, Buddha saw that he could not do anything for his relatives, because the karma they did in the past is about to give results at that time, and nobody can interfere with the working of karma. So for the at the fourth time, Buddha did not went out. And so Vidudapa went there and killed almost all Sakya people. And it was said in the books that blood flowed like a river. And after killing the Sakyans, his army rested in a riverbed, a dry riverbed. And when they were sleeping at night, a very heavy rain came at that night, and the flood took all these people together with Vidudapa to the sea, and they became food of crocodiles and fish and others. So here, after the Sakyans died, monks asked Buddha that it is not fair that Sakyans had to die in this way. And Buddha said, if you look at this life only, it would be unfair for them to die this way. But they get what they deserve because they did something in the past. So in the past, they threw poison in the water. All of them conspired together and threw poison in the water. And this is the result of their karma. So they suffer the result of karma together at the same time. But the karma of each one gives results to that particular person. Not one karma giving result to another person. But it's something like a mass karma. And the second one is Samavati being burnt with 500 women. Samavati was a queen of a certain king, and she was very dear to him. But there was another queen who was jealous. So one day, Queen Samavati with 500 women were burnt. When they were in the palace, in the building, the people bolted the doors and then put fire to the building, and so they burned with the building. And when the monks asked Buddha about this incident, Buddha said, they also got what they deserve as a result of what they did in the past. In the past, they were a queen of a certain king also. At that time, eight Pachika Buddhas, you know Pachika Buddhas, private Buddhas or silent Buddhas, they are between Buddha and Arahants, somewhere between Buddha and Arahants, higher than the Arahants and lower than the Buddhas. So they came and to eat at the garden, at the king's garden. And then seven went back and one will remain there. And after eating, he got into Samapati attainment to enjoy the bliss of liberation. And so he went to a place on a heap of straw, and then sat on it and went into attainment, went into jhana attainment. At that time, the women who are playing in the river with water got cold, and so they wanted to warm themselves, and so they thought that was just a heap of straw, so they put fire to the heap and warm themselves. But after some time, they saw the monk Pachika Buddha sitting there, and so they thought, we have set fire to the monk, and if the king knows this, then all of us will be killed. So let us put some more wood and straw on it and let it burn so that nobody knows. So they put some more wood and all other things and then set fire to it and went back. So that was the karma they did. So as a result of that karma in the present life, they were burnt alive in the with the building. So that also they suffered together because they did the karma together in the past. And the third one is about Prince Bodhi. It is in the story of him is in the Majjhima Nikaya, the book of middle length sayings, in the 85th sutta of that Nikaya. There was a prince named Bodhi. He invited Buddha for alms one day, and before Buddha came, he prepared his place. And he spread some white cloth on the staircase to his place. And when Buddha came, he invited Buddha to step on the white cloth and to go to his seat. But Buddha just stopped there and did not step on the cloth. He asked Buddha 2-3 times. Buddha did not say anything, but Buddha looked at Ananda, his attendant. So Ananda knew that Buddha would not step on the white cloth. So he said, "Prince, remove the cloth. Buddha will not step on the cloth." So he removed, and Buddha went, and then Buddha gave him his. He asked some questions, and Buddha gave him a sama. The commentaries explained why Buddha did not step on the white cloth, because that prince had no children, so he wanted offspring. So he thought, if I do something good and wish for it, then I may get an offspring. So he decided to give alms to the Buddha, and also he made a wish, something like a wish in his mind, that if I am to get a son, Buddha would step on the white cloth, and if I would not get a son, then Buddha would not. So with that in mind, he asked the Buddha to step on it, and Buddha did not, because Buddha saw that he was not going to have any offspring in that life, because in a past life, both he and his wife were stranded on an island, and since there was nothing to eat, they killed young birds and ate those birds. So as a result of that, in this life, and they were without offspring. And it is said in the commentary that if one of them did not kill the birds, then they would have got a child. But now both of them agree with each other and kill birds and ate them, so that as a result of that karma, they were without child. So two people doing some bad karma together and suffering the results of the bad karma together in that life. So that is something like mass karma, but not one karma affecting many people, but each karma affecting each people. Now we come to the law of karma. Now, the law of karma is an important teaching in the Buddha's teachings. And before we study the law of karma, we should study the Subha's questions and Buddha's answers, because it explains the inequality in human beings or in beings in general. So please read the last page of the notes. So once a Brahmin youth named Subha came to the Buddha and asked him why some people, although they are human beings, are short-lived and some long-lived and so on. So he wanted to know that why some people, although they are equal as human beings, some people live longer, some people died young, and some people are sickly or always ill, or some people are healthy and so on. So he asked the Buddha, and Buddha said, "O Brahmin youth, beings have karma as their own property. They are heirs of their karma. They have karma as their progenitor, karma as their kin, karma as their homing place. It is karma that differentiates beings according to inferiority and superiority." So Buddha gave him a very brief answer. But he said, I don't understand fully what you said. So please elaborate on it," something like that. So Buddha explained him in detail. Now, what he asked was, why people, although they are human beings, equal as human beings, some live longer and some live shorter? And the answer is, people are short-lived because they killed beings in the past. And people are long-lived, or people live longer lives, because they refrained from killing in the past. So killing causes short life, and refraining from killing causes long life. And some are sickly because they persecuted beings in the past, and some are healthy because they refrain from persecuting beings. And some are ugly because they were resentful. That means they get angry very easily. And some are beautiful because they were not resentful. That means they avoid anger. So anger makes people ugly. That's very true. I always say to people, if you are angry, just look at yourself in the mirror. So you see how ugly you are when you are angry, and so it will dissolve when you look at yourself in the mirror. And then some people are significant or important persons, and some are non-important persons, and some are influential persons or important persons. And they are so because they were envious, and they refrain from being envious. So those people who are envious become insignificant beings, and those people who avoid envy becomes influential persons. And there are poor and rich. So poor people are those who did not practice giving in the past, and rich people are those who practice giving in the past. So giving is the first step in the practice of Buddha's teachings. Giving makes minds soft, and if a person is not going to to get enlightenment in this life, then the practice of giving is very helpful, because those who give are born rich or at least well-to-do persons, and so they don't have to worry about their living. And also when people are well-to-do, it is the circumstances are favorable for them to avoid evil deeds. And some are low-born because they were haughty or they were proud, and some are high-born because they were not haughty, they were humble. And some are stupid because they did not ask questions, and some are wise because they ask questions. So I always say, American people will be wise persons in their next lives because they ask many questions. So this is the answer given by the Buddha. So why people are not equal, although they are equal as human beings, some live long and some live short and so on. So the explanation is that they have different karmas. So some people kill beings, and so they will be reborn in hell for many, many years, and then from after escaping from hell, they will be reborn as human beings, and when they are reborn as human beings, they will have a short life. And those who refrain from killing will not go to hell and other woeful states, and when they become, when they are reborn as human beings, they will live long and so on. So this is the the explanation of inequality in, let us say, human beings. Why people are not equal or not the same. So this is the answer given by Buddhism to this question of inequality. And Nagasena's answers to Milinda's question, that the same answer was given by Venerable Nagasena to Milinda. So if you want to read Milinda's question, then please read part 1, page 89. And this law of karma is the law of cause and effect. So where there is cause, there is effect. And no effect comes into being without a cause. And it is a law of action and reaction. When there is action, there is reaction. So nothing comes out of nothing according to this law. And it is a natural law. That is why it does not need a lawmaker or lawgiver. Nobody makes this law, but it is natural law, like law of gravitation. And since it is a natural law, nobody can interfere or intervene in the working of karma. Even Buddha could not really save his relatives from being killed by Vidudaba. So it is a natural law and operates in its own field without the intervention of an external independent ruling agency. So no lawgiver, although there is law. Nobody, including the Buddha, can intervene in the operation of karma. And understanding of the law of karma is one aspect of right understanding. Now, we are encouraged to follow the Noble Eightfold Path, or to practice Noble Eightfold Path. And Noble Eightfold Path consists of eight factors, and the first factor mentioned there is right understanding. And right understanding has different levels. The highest stage is at the stage of enlightenment. Right understanding of the Four Noble Truths and right understanding of Nibbana. On lower level, the understanding of law of karma or belief in a law of karma is also called right understanding. And it is very important for Buddhists. So all Buddhists must have this understanding of law of karma. Understanding of karma alone as one's own property. In Pali, we call kammasaka. Beings have karma as their property and nothing else. So whatever we suffer or enjoy in this life is the result of karma. Although not everything that we experience that occur in us or to us is caused by karma. Now, is everything due to karma? And in the Buddhist dictionary, the Venerable Jnanatiloka again wrote, totally wrong is the belief that, according to Buddhism, everything is the result of previous action. Never, for example, is any karmically wholesome or unwholesome volitional action, karma, the result of former action, being in reality itself karma.
I didn't understand what you just said.
This?
Never is any
karmically wholesome or unwholesome volitional action the result of former action. any karmically wholesome or unwhosome volitional action is not the result of former action, because it is the action itself. Now, you have studied the types of consciousness. So there are types of consciousness which are called resultant. So the resultant consciousness are the result of karma. But the others are not the result of karma. The unwholesome consciousness, wholesome consciousness, and also functional consciousness, they are not the result of karma. So, not everything is due to karma. Not everything is caused by karma. Now, we see something, something desirable. And that seeing consciousness is caused by karma, right? It is result in karma. But our reaction to that seeing or to that object is not karma, not caused by karma. It is really the karma we accumulate or we perform, a new karma we perform. So our reaction to that object is not caused by karma, although the seeing of that object. Not everything is due to karma. Not everything is caused by karma. Now, we see something, something desirable. And that seeing consciousness is caused by karma, right? It is resultant karma. But our reaction to that seeing or to that object is not karma, not caused by karma. It is really the karma we accumulate or we perform, a new karma we perform. So our reaction to that object is not caused by karma, although the seeing of that object is caused by karma. So not everything is due to karma. Seeing in your mind, seeing consciousness arises in your mind, and that is the result of karma. When you see a desirable object, that is the result of good karma, and when you see an undesirable object, it is the result of bad karma in the past.
Well, I want to understand that very much. When I see a desirable object, is because I result of my good karma,
yeah,
to be able to perceive this.
Yes.
I desirable, you mean beautiful? What kind of thing?
Yes.
Like beholding a jewel, that would be to me a thing, or a flower, or anything beautiful, right?
Yeah.
That is good karma. That
result of good karma.
That a person is able to appreciate the beauty, or I'm not really clear on that. I know, I hear what you're saying, but...
Yeah, seeing a rose, let's say a beautiful rose, seeing a beautiful rose is the result of good karma.
I don't understand that. Exactly that point I don't understand.
You did something good in the past and you get the result of that karma here. But the rose is not the result of your karma. The rose is a natural thing. It is inanimate.
It exists independently of
right.
my good karma or bad karma.
Right.
But that I am able to appreciate, is that where the good karma...
That you come across this rose, that you see this rose is the result of karma.
And also that I'm able to appreciate because perhaps there are...
Appreciation can mean either kusala or akusala. If you have attachment to the rose, then your reaction is akusala. Not the result.
And if
your reaction is see the nature, true nature of things, that it is going to wither away, it is impermanent and so on, then you don't get attached to it, and then your reaction is kusala.
If it is only appreciation or admiration, and one doesn't get attached to the object or to the person or whatever is beautiful, then that is...
That... The appreciation can either be kusala or akusala. Appreciation really means you like something.
Mm-hmm.
So that liking is a kind of loba, a kind of attachment. It may be not a strong attachment, but still it is attachment. It cannot give bad results in the woeful state, but still it is akusala. Like when you eat with attachment. So whatever things you come across in this life, when they are good or bad, is the result of karma in the past. But your reaction to this is a new karma you do in this life. That is why I say not everything is due to karma.
One will be good or not good karma according to one's reaction.
That's right.
To this desirable.
Yes. To the objects, whether desirable or undesirable. And then, not everything is the result of previous action. So never is any karmically wholesome or unwholesome volitional action the result of former action, because they are themselves karma. And who is the doer of karma? And who enjoys the or who experiences the results of karma? And it is a very difficult question to explain, because Buddhism does not accept person or being, actually, or Atman. But we say if you do good deeds here, then you will get good results in the future, or you get good results because you did something good deed in the past.
Excuse me, if Buddhism doesn't accept the continuity of an entity, then who creates the karma and who experiences the karma and who expiates the karma? If there is not a continuity in an entity, whatever.
No, it is you who creates karma. You create karma. You create karma.
Uh-huh.
You do karma.
But did I misunderstand you to say that Buddhism doesn't, that in the sight of Buddhism there is no continuity of existence, that there is not an entity? Maybe I didn't understand you.
Yeah, I think I explained this last week when I talk about the relinking and death and relinking consciousness. I mean, the thought process. Buddhism accepts identity as well as diversity. There is continuity, but not identical mind and matter existing for a long time. At every moment, new mind and matter arise and disappears. And next moment, another new pair of mind and matter, and so on. So there is something like a continuity, but not, they are not identical. Not anything from this moment is taken over or goes over to another moment. This is how Buddhism accepts the beings and also rebirth and so on. So in the ultimate analysis, there is no doer of no doer of karma or no experiencer of results, because he sees no doer over and above the doing, no experiencer of the result over and above the occurrence of the result. He means a yogi, a practitioner of vipassana meditation. So when you practice vipassana meditation and you reach that stage of vipassana knowledge, then you see no doer over and above or apart from the doing. So apart from doing, there is no one we can call a doer. And apart from the occurrence or arising of result, there is no one who experiences the result. That is in the ultimate sense. But in conventional language, we have to say, and we do say, that I get the results of good karma in the past or bad karma in the past. But in the ultimate analysis, we cannot find any doer or any experiencer apart from the doing or the action of doing and the occurrence of result. So, but he sees clearly with right understanding that the wise say doer when there is doing and experiencer when there is experiencing, simply as a mode of common usage. So just for convenience of usage, we say I experience or I get the results of past karma, or I am the doer of this karma and I am the enjoyer or sufferer of the karma. But there is no doer or no one who reaps the result of the good or bad karma. So there is no doer of a deed or one who reaps the deed's result. Phenomena alone go on. Phenomena means mind and matter. Just mind and matter go on and on and on. No other view than this is right. And karma and its results are two different things. This is also very important. Karma is one thing and result is another. Although they are connected as karma and result, karma does not exist in result and result does not exist in karma. We have to be very clear about this. And because in one system of Hindu philosophy, the Sankhya system, it is believed that the effect already exists in the cause in an unmanifested form. So when we say the result arises, we just mean that it manifests itself at that moment. So according to that philosophy, the effects already exist in the cause. But when it is at the moment of cause, it is not manifest. So we do not really see. But when it becomes an effect, we see it clearly. So the effect is existent in the cause in an unmanifest form. And when it becomes a result, then it is manifested. So this is the teaching of Sankhya philosophy. But Buddhism, say, denies that. And Buddhism teaches that karma is one thing and result, karma vibhaka, is another. But they are not disconnected altogether. They are connected as cause and effect. So there is no karma in result, nor does result exist in karma. Though they are void of one another, there is no karma in result and no result in karma. Though they are void of one another, there is no fruit without the karma. As fire does not exist inside the sun, a gem, cow dung, nor yet outside them, but is brought to be by means of its component parts. So neither can result be found within the karma nor without, nor does the karma still persist in the result it has produced. The karma of its fruit is void, no fruit yet exists in the karma, and still the fruit is born from it, wholly depending on the karma. For there is no Brahma God, creator of the round of rebirths. Phenomena alone flow on, cause and component, they are conditioned. So, karma and results are two different things. That is why I'm uncomfortable when I read in the manual of Abhidhamma says the effect already blooms in the cause. I don't know what that means. It sure points out to that Sankhya philosophy, and I think we cannot say that. The effect already blooms in the cause. If we say that, then we virtually accept the teaching of Sankhya philosophy. So, cause is one thing, or karma is one thing, and effect is another. But there is a connection between them as cause and effect. That is why cause A produces effect A, and not cause A produces effect B, and so on. So we have this kind of connection as karma and result. But karma is one thing and result is another. If you're interested, you may read some books on Indian philosophy. And there is, it's interesting because in those days, people are always, arguing with each other. It's like a debate, something from this side wrote something, and then there is a rejoinder from others. And they give examples both of them are convincing examples. So, according to the teachings of Buddha or teachings of Theravada Buddhism, then karma and its results are two different things, not one to be found in the other. Now, there are different kinds of karma. Generally, we just say good karma or bad karma, or kusala karma or akusala karma. But they are classified according to their function and their priority of result and the time of taking place of result and the place in which results take place. So the first division is according to function. Reproductive karma, supportive karma, obstructive karma, and destructive karma. Reproductive karma means the karma that produces results. Supportive karma does not produce the results, but supports the results of another karma. And obstructive karma is something like supportive karma. It is in the opposite sense. So it can interfere with the result of other karma. And destructive karma is one that destroys the result of the other karma. So the karma can both be good or bad, kusala or akusala. So according to the functions, there are four kinds of karma. And with respect to priority of result, that means weighty karma, proximate karma, habitual karma, and reserve karma. Weighty karma means karma like jhanas, or with regard to akusala, karma like killing one's own father, killing one's own mother, and so on. They are supposed to be very grievous offenses in Buddhism. So, weighty karma means those that give result in the next life. If you get jhana in this life and you die with the jhana intact, then you will be reborn in the Brahma world. You are sure to reborn there. And if you kill your father or mother, and according to the teachings of Theravada, you are sure to go to the lowest of the hells.
Excuse me, I may ask, what is the karma produced by women who
abortion may be legal, but it is not wholesome. Abortion is killing, and so it is akusala. So being legal and being kusala or akusala are different. It becomes legal because the government say it is all right to do that, and so it becomes legal. But it does not mean that it is ethical, or there are no bad effects of abortion or killing.
What would be the effect of such an action? If a woman resists that, is she carrying? Is she going to be sterile as a result of that? It would seem to me that would be the logical result, would it not? That when they want a child, they can't have it.
Since it is killing, then the consequences of killing are bad results in the future lives. Like even though born as a human being, that person won't live long, and so on. So weighty karma, and proximate karma is karma done at the moment of death. Just before death, people do karma, and that karma is called proximate karma. And habitual karma is the karma which one does habitually in one's life. paying homage to the Buddha every day, chanting every day, practicing meditation every day, and so on. These are called habitual karma. And proximate karma is the one done just before death. And reserve karma is other than the three above. Now, they are called reserve karma. Now, when there is vedi karma and proximate karma, then vedi karma will give result in the next life. When there is proximate and habitual, then proximate karma will give result in the next life. And if there is habitual and reserved, then habitual karma will give result. If there are no weighty proximate and habitual karmas, then the reserved karma will give results. So, with respect to priority of giving results, there are four kinds of karma. Now, proximate karma is very important in Buddhism, because it can cause a person, even an evil person, to be reborn in a good existence, at least for a short time. You know, there is a story of a hunter who had been a hunter all his life, and in his old age he was ordained and became a monk. And he had a son who was an arahant. When he was about to die, he saw the signs of destiny, bad signs of destiny, like he was followed by dogs and other things. And so he shouted, "Son, help me," or something like that. So the son knew that his father was going to be reborn in hell. So he took his, he had his pupils take his father to the shrine, and then give him flowers to offer to the Buddha. So when he offered flowers to the Buddha, his mind was changed. And he, at that time, that karma becomes proximate kusala karma. And so the signs of destiny also changed, and he saw celestial beings and others. And he died and he was born as a celestial being. But the son knew that he was not going to be there for long, because all his life he had been killing animals. So he went up to the celestial world and preached to him, so that he became a sotapanna. He became, the father became enlightened. So proximate karma is also important. And when there is when there are proximate karma and habitual karma, then the proximate karma give results. So there are four kinds of these karmas. With respect to time of taking place of result, there are karma which give result in present life, and there are karmas which give results in next life, and there are karmas which give results in other life than present and next lives. When I read it today, I was afraid, because people might take that other life than present and next life, other life than present and next life, taking as one. But here it means from the third life onwards. Suppose this life is first life, and the next life is second life, and then one after next is third life. So from the third onwards is the field of taking place of results for the third one. And the fourth is the defunct karma. Sometimes karma can give no results. That is because it has passed its time of giving results. Suppose you do some karma and it can give results in this life, but no circumstances are favorable for that karma to give results in this life, and so the time passed.
So there's and a statute of limitations.
That's right.
What is it?
Yeah. So it becomes defunct. It becomes ineffective. And then there are some kind of karma which give results in next life, and we call it second life. And there are others which give results in third life, and so on. And if they do not give, I mean, if the karma does not give in the next life, then that karma becomes defunct. But for the third one, third kind of karma, there can be no defunct karma, because in this long series of rebirths, at one time they may give results. So this is the hope of all people, the third kind of karma. Now, people often ask, if a being is reborn as an animal, how can he be reborn as a human being again? Because being an animal, what he will be doing is mostly akusala. But this true of the third kind of karma is always with beings. And so some kusala karma he did in the past may get chance to give results. And so he can escape from being an animal or from being in hell. So this is the hope we have with regard to our future, this the third kind of karma. And nobody is free from the third kind of karma. Everybody has store of this karma.
I am confused because I have never heard those concepts which you are expounding tonight about this karma, which if it doesn't become realized, it becomes dissolved.
Defunct,
Would you please give me an example to help me to understand, because I really don't understand. I thought that karma was an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and that it was a ruthless process of creating exactly what one puts out. And what you said invalidates that concept, because now karma has another dimension.
You know the seven moments of Javana?
The what?
Seven moments of Javana. You don't know that. You have to go back to the thought process. So in the thought process, there are seven moments of Javana. That is the moment when you acquire kusala or akusala karma. Now, it is said in the books that the first Javana, I mean, the karma arising with the first Javana, is the one that gives results in this life.
Please excuse me for being so ignorant, but what is the meaning of Javana?
if I say in English, you will not understand either, because I cannot explain. Javana is translated as a perception, or impulsion. I don't know any other English word for Javana. It is a moment when you experience the object fully. It is a moment when you acquire karma. That's called Javana. And it runs for seven times, it is said in the books. Thought moment, seven moments. So the first moment is the one that gives results in this life. And the last one, the seventh moment, seventh Javana, is that which gives life, which gives result in the next life. And the five in between are those which give result from the third life onwards. So, if the first Javana does not give result in this life, it becomes defunct. It becomes nothing. And if the seventh Javana does not give result in the next life, then it passes its time of ripening, and so it does not give results at all. But the five Javanas in between the first and the seventh, can give result from the third to until you die as an arahant. So it can never go defunct until you become an arahant. So the defunct karma is not a separate karma from the first three, but when they become ineffective, they are called defunct karma. And the last one is what? With respect to place in which results take place, unwholesome karma. Unwholesome karma give results in the four woeful states and in human beings, and even in some celestial beings too. And wholesome karma pertaining to sense sphere, they give results in every kind of existence. And wholesome karma pertaining to form sphere, they give results in form sphere only, and wholesome karma pertaining to formless sphere give results in formless sphere only. Because the resultant consciousness, the middle columns of Rupa Vajra and Arupa Vajra, arise only in Rupa Vajra and Arupa Vajra respectively. They do not arise in any other existences. But the wholesome karma pertaining to sense sphere, karma vajra, wholesome karma, can give results anywhere. And the result of karma, what is the result of karma? What do we mean by the result of karma? Only two things. One is chetas and chetasikas, and two, rupa or material properties born of karma. So they are really called results of karma. We have there are resultant types of consciousness, and chetasikas going along with them, and they are called result of karma. And then there are some material properties in our bodies that are caused by karma. Now we have studied about matter. Sometime in the back. And so, there are material properties which are caused by karma, and there are others which are caused by consciousness or cheta, and there are others which are caused by climatic conditions, and others which are caused by food. So, those caused by karma arise only in living beings. So, for example, the eye sensitivity, the ear sensitivity, and so on, are caused by karma. So when we say the result of karma, we mean this. The material properties caused by karma, and the resultant consciousness, and chetasikas accompanying that consciousness. So, like I said, a rose is not the result of karma. It is just there. It is simply there, depending on the natural causes. But the seeing of it or your experience of it is caused by karma. Or actually, the seeing of it is caused by karma, the seeing consciousness. The consciousness by which you see the rose is caused by karma. And your reaction to that object, to that rose, is the karma you do here in this life. So this way, there is the result of karma and a new karma, and then there will be result of this new karma again later. So this way, cause and effect goes on and on and on. Yeah. What do you want to ask?
Do animals have karma? Do they have karma or not?
Who?
Animals. And the, I wanted to ask a dual question in this respect of animals. If a man goes hunting because it's the tradition, because his father told him it was all right, and he goes hunting. Specifically, I have an in-law who goes hunting, and this in-law is very close to me, and he goes hunting, and these hunters, do they acquire very bad karma? To him, he's not doing anything wrong, and to me it horrifies me, but to him, you see, he has not the sense that it is wrong. So, because he doesn't have the sense that it is wrong, is he going to be adversely affected in his karma by this? Or because I don't think the hunters have a sense that it is wrong. I don't think how horrible it is.
Right.
They think it's okay. So are they going to have the karmically accountable?
But what if someone comes to kill him?
What if somebody?
Somebody comes to kill him.
In which sense?
Would he take it as...
Philosophically, no.
Would he take it as all right?
No.
For him to be killed?
Absolutely not.
Then why does he think that it is right to kill animals?
The attacker, he would not take it lying down. I assure you that.
No, no, I mean not taking lying down.
He would think it's horrible that anybody even thinks of killing him. He would not condone on anybody attempting to destroy him, but he thinks it's all right for him to destroy life, to destroy any life.
So it is fair if he thinks that to kill other is all right, but to be killed is not all right.
This is the type of consciousness that exists in this person. What you are saying is doing that. So what happens to such an individual?
He gets akusala if he kills.
But there is another angle to this karma which I would like you to explain to me.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
If karma is taught this way and explained this way, how do you keep people or an entire culture from becoming indignant to other people's suffering? For instance, saying, well, that person is poor because they deserve it, you know, in some other life, so what? You know, or 12 million people get killed, you know, in World War II, well, they must have done something to deserve it. Or, you know, bombs are falling on people's heads, they must have done something to deserve it. How do you, it seems there's some way that when you talk about it, it hits me as if people will become indifferent to the suffering of other people because somehow they deserve that. When you talk about so much deserving,
The law of karma is just as it is. And when people do, say, good or bad karma, they are bound to get the results of their karma. But it does not mean that we are not to help people. We are not to not to relieve people of suffering. So as much as we can, well, we must do whatever we can to relieve suffering of people. But if we cannot do any longer, any further, then we have to blame it on karma. That is the point. Because people often cross over to another territory. Suppose the compassion or karuna is a good quality to promote, to cultivate. But along with cultivating karuna, we often go or cross over into anger. Because, say, now people are using animals in laboratories, and we have compassion for them, and we don't want them to suffer. And at the same time, we are angry with those people who inflict pain on these dumb animals. So, or sometimes, one time a woman told me that she suffered much when she heard things like that. And so she had a lot of suffering. So I told her, when we practice karuna, or compassion, we have to be mindful of two enemies. One is the far enemy, and the other is near enemy, direct enemy and indirect enemy. And direct enemy is cruelty. It's very easy to understand. But the near enemy is that depression or anger. So we have to avoid this also, because when we are indignant about that and when we become angry, then we are not practicing karuna any longer. We are having akusala at that time.
Exactly.
But we can help. We can do whatever we can to help people get relief from suffering. We cannot close our eyes and say it is just the effect of karma or whatever. But we do not know that what we are going to do to them is whether the result of their karma. So nobody sees, nobody can see the limit of karma. So we must do whatever we can for other people too. But when we cannot do anything, or when sometimes we met with failure or whatever, instead of blaming it on others or blaming it on the situations, we have to blame ourselves because it is our the result of our bad karma in the past or something like that. So the knowledge of the law of karma, the knowledge that beings have karma only as their property and so on, helps us in many ways, especially when we cannot be consoled by any other means. Yes.
Can you say that everything doesn't happen because of karma too, also? So that my idea is that you would help people because it might not have been because of their karma, it might have been from other causes and not their personal karma. Am I correct or am I wrong? I mean, it wouldn't stop me from trying to help someone.
Yes.
Because of
karma. But we do not know to what extent the karma of the other person has potential. So what we do for them may be the result of their karma. We cannot see their karma goes as far as this and no farther. We cannot see that.
That's how I was one time explaining to you. It's not like you can pull this one thing and say, oh, well, that's why they do this here. It's also interwoven.
That's right, yes. Yeah.
During meditation, you could experience different mental states directly. But can you experience karma directly?
Every moment of meditation, there is karma. Because volition is always there. The volition is a chetasika which accompanies every type of consciousness. So volition is always there.
And so essentially, you can always be experiencing karma.
Yeah, yes.
When you attend to your experience.
Right, yeah. So you acquire karma through meditation. A very powerful, good karma. Buddha once said, "And the four foundations of mindfulness is a great accumulation of wholesome kusala. And the hindrances are a great accumulation of akusala."
Okay.
Thank you. Animals have karma. Yes, they have karma too.
Although they don't have the volition, do they?